the theme for this retreat is building the Buddha land. And the inspiration for this theme for the retreat comes from the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the teaching or instruction of Vimalakirti, which is a remarkable Mahayana work, scripture, actually full of humour, almost slapstick at times. For example, when Sariputra, one of the great arahats, finds himself changing sex, you know, into a woman and back again, to his great consternation. So yes, it's a remarkable work, full of humour, magic and profound wisdom. It's a wonderful work. And the introduction to the Vimalakirti Nirdesha for many of us came in a series of talks given by Sangharakshita in, I think it was 1979, in the autumn of 1979, under the general title of the Inconceivable Emancipation. It was quite something at the time. I'd just been around just a very short time, and I remember us at the Norwich Buddhist Centre waiting eagerly week by week for the latest cassette to arrive, you know, and we'd all sit around and listen to the latest talk in this sort of unfolding cosmic drama. And it was the last full series of talks that Bhante gave, and it's certainly one to be remembered. So yes, we have in the Vimalakirti this incredibly rich and colourful universe and profound teaching, and we're going to be just turning to one incident in the story. I'm afraid the rest of it will have to wait for some other time. So the incident that the story comes from, the Buddha is at Amrapali's park at Vaishali. So there's a historical context. The park was given to the Buddha by a very famous courtesan. But the historical reality quickly fades, because the Buddha is surrounded by this vast assembly of 8,000 arahats, enlightened monks, and 32,000 bodhisattvas, sort of prince-like in all their jewels and silks and so on. So the Buddha is there with this great assembly, and they're visited by the bodhisattva Ratnakara, this youthful bodhisattva, with 500 Lichava youths, all carrying beautiful bejeweled parasols, which they offer to the Buddha. And the Buddha takes these parasols and turns them into a single precious canopy, covering the entire billion world galaxy, in which all the stars, heavens, worlds and so on can be seen. So, not surprisingly, Ratnakara praises the Buddha, and then he explains that these youths, all these bodhisattvas that have come with him from Vaishali, they're all set on enlightenment for the sake of all beings, and they have a question. They have a question for the Buddha. They want to ask the Buddha about the bodhisattva's purification of a Buddha field. And the Buddha responds, good, good question. And he gives then a very full and very extended answer to the question. Just give you a little extract of the Buddha's answer. The Buddha said, "Noble sons, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. Why so? A bodhisattva embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that he causes the development of living beings. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that living beings become disciplined. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that, through entrance into a Buddha field, living beings are introduced to the Buddha gnosis. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that, through entrance into that Buddha field, living beings increase their holy spiritual faculties. Why so? Noble son, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas springs from the aims of living beings. And he goes on in that vein for quite a while. So we have then this myth in the most positive sense, myth in the sense of a sort of imaginative story, if you like, that captures a higher truth that we can engage with. This myth of building the Buddha land or creating a Buddha field, a Buddha land. And this myth of the Buddha field creating the Buddha land has always been a very evocative one for me. I suppose it echoes the heady socialist ideas of my youth, you know, the ideas of building, creating a better world. But that project, you know, the great revolutionary socialist vision, was fraught with difficulties, not least the uncomfortable evidence of history as to how revolutions with their high ideals often went sour and ended up being more oppressive than what went before. And I wasn't greatly encouraged to think that this time it might be different when I looked round at the competing left-wing factions that I knew, each laying claim to truth being the truest and best analysis of the situation and what needed to be done. And also the obviously unintegrated characters of myself and my comrades. You know, you'd hear throwaway remarks like, come the revolution, you lot will be the first to be lined up against the wall and shot. And you know, people were joking, but actually, you know, you could imagine in different circumstances it wouldn't be a joke anymore. So one way or another, I seemed to forsake that revolution and took a more active interest in some sort of spiritual path. Again, rather winding, at times confused journey. You know, it took me along the hippie trail to India, to the feet of various Hindu gurus, as well as to Buddhist holy places and a Buddhist meditation course at Bodh Gaya, the place of the enlightenment. And then back to Britain and back to the land, back to nature. Several years farming, including 3 as a house parent and farmer in a working village community with people with learning difficulties, so, you know, still looking for another way of living. And then eventually to a more serious engagement with Buddhist teaching and practice. And that aspiration to do something about building a better world remained. So I did feel a real immediate heartfelt response when Sangha Rakshita spoke then, as he often did, of creating a new society through the unfolding efforts of committed men and women in the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And also when I met traditional teachings as expounded in the Vimalakirti Nidesha series by Bhante around building the Buddha land, creating a Buddha field. So you may not be aware, but the word Buddhism isn't a traditional Buddhist word or the translation of a traditional Buddhist word. It's a word of Western coinage. The Buddhist tradition spoke of the Buddha Dharma, the truth as communicated, realized by a Buddha. And you also find often in the Buddhist tradition talk of the Buddha Sasana. So Sasana is the sphere of influence of a king. This is its usual usage. So in ancient times, historical times, at a certain point, geographical point, the armies, the tax collectors of a king wouldn't be able to operate effectively any longer. They'd no longer be able to protect the citizens from bandits, marauders, foreign powers. So it's as if the sasana of a king extended as far as his authority, and then when that dissolve broke down, that was the end of his sasana. His sasana ran out. And obviously this also operates over time, as the sasana of a king might expand contract, shrink, even disappear. You know, so we can think of the Roman Empire, how that grew and shrank, no more than a memory now. The British Empire, you know, it's as if they had a sasana that grew and shrank. So the Buddha sasana, the sasana of Buddha Shakyamuni, refers to the field of his spiritual influence, which began to expand 2,500 years ago, and you could say still runs on through time. Geographically, this Buddha sasana has expanded and shrunk. It disappeared historically from India nearly 1,000 years ago, and is now returning. This whole part of Central Asia, where at one time you could say the Buddha sasana was very strong, and where it's now disappeared. You know, you may all recollect seeing those great Buddhist statues at Bamiyan in Afghanistan, which were destroyed by the Taliban. You know, they were part of a one-time thriving Buddhist world of monastic communities that stretched all the way through Central Asia, all the way along the Silk Route to China, which has disappeared. So, yes, and now we could say the Buddha sasana, if fading in some of its traditional homelands, is expanding to the west. So there's something very mysterious here. You know, the Buddha was enlightened, a human being touched this profound wisdom and compassion. And his teaching, his communication to other people, set in motion, if you like, a sphere of spiritual influence that somehow still touches us today, that can still transform our lives today, can still bring us to a new vision of existence if we make the effort, allow it to bring us into harmony and resonance with the Buddha's own wisdom and compassion. So this sense of a whole field or sphere of influence that has expanded and contracted and somehow can still touch us today, this sphere of influence, this field of influence of a Buddha. And this metaphor of a field, you know, a Buddha field, the field, something cultivated, cleared of stones and weeds, where the seeds and saplings that are planted can thrive and grow. You know, we all know if we plant or throw seeds on hard, uncultivated soil, even if it's fertile, nothing is likely to happen. Whilst with well-cultivated soil, where the surface has been broken, where it's well-tended, the plants, the seeds will be able to flourish. Nature will take care of the rest. And we can follow this sort of metaphor through of the field, you know, with the Buddha as a sort of farmer or gardener, or the Bodhisattva, the follower of the Buddha dedicated to attainment of enlightenment for all beings, doing the work of the gardener or the farmer, if you like, cultivating the soil of the field in which living beings can flourish. And there's much talk in the Buddhist scriptures, the Buddhist tradition, of bodhisattvas, the Buddha, ripening or maturing beings, bringing them, leading them step by step along the way through a process of spiritual development and unfoldment to spiritual flowering or fruition. And also the images of the Buddha as a great sun shining down on all alike, you know, helping them to grow. And his Dharma, his teaching, as a great rain cloud. We find this image in the White Lotus Sutra. The Dharma is a rain cloud, bestowing rain, nourishment, refreshment on all alike. Whether a small plant or bush, a small seedling, a great tree, each receives the nourishment of the Dharma alike, as each receives the nourishment of the rain alike. So all able to grow and fulfil their own deepest nature. The Buddhist tradition also speaks of pure and impure Buddha fields or Buddha lands. So there are pure Buddha lands. Probably the best known of these is Sukhavati, the pure land of the Buddha Amitabha. And in these pure lands, beings destined for enlightenment are born, as it were, to complete their unfoldment. They can't go wrong. You know, once you're born in a pure land, everything supports your spiritual progress. No mundane concerns, you know, no jobs to go to, no houses, you know, no worries about food. Everything there just supporting one's Dharma life. Everything resonating with the Dharma, leading one more and more deeply into reality. So this is the world of a pure Buddha land, as described in the Buddhist tradition. There's some very lovely verses that from the Bodhicharya Avatara that really move me whenever I hear them. They're sort of aspiration verses for the sort of world that really supports one's efforts in the Dharma. So Shantideva in the Bodhicharya Avatara says, "May the sounds of the Dharma ever be heard by all beings, in the songs of the birds, in the whispering of the trees, even in the dancing sunbeams." So a very lovely sense, you know, that everything just speaks to one of the Dharma. Everything, as it were, takes one deeper into that profound vision of wisdom and compassion. So there are the pure lands, the pure Buddha fields, but then there's also other Buddha fields, Buddha lands that are much more mixed. The influence of a Buddha is there, but there's also many other influences that, you know, some of them evil, destructive, others indifferent. Very much like our own world. Our own world is said to be an impure Buddha land, an impure Buddha world. The Dharma is present in places very strongly, in other places not at all. So the work of the Bodhisattva is to actually purify the Buddha field, to strengthen and clarify the influence of the Dharma, the influence, if you like, of the good, and to counter the negative forces and influences. So we have a Buddha field and we have the work of purifying a Buddha field or a Buddha land, actually creating a more and more dharmic environment, an environment where wisdom, where compassion, where all the profoundest qualities of enlightenment are able to flourish more and more easily and naturally. When we think about it, you know, when we really think about it, we constantly create and recreate a world around us. You know, think of your own room. Your room is a world, a reflection, extension of your own mind and being. It's a bit of a disturbing thought, actually, when you look in some people's rooms. It might be when you look in your own room. You know, this is you. This is the world that you create around you. You know, so the posters, the colours, the objects, the music you play, the books, everything, you know, somehow this is you creating, expanding into a world. And more than that, the people create a world around them that can be light, friendly. Others create a world around them that's quite aggressive, fearful, unpredictable. You know, we can probably all think of people, you know, when they enter our world, something changes. It's they're friendlier, they're kinder, we feel more at ease with other people. You know, they sort of carry a world of aggression, tension around with them. And of course, human beings get together with other human beings, and they start to create a more extended world into which others are drawn or by which others are repelled. You know, again, we can think just of families, workplaces, street gangs, societies. You know, societies in the sense of just people who get together out of a shared interest, or a whole society or culture. You know, we can think of the world that was created in Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia or war-torn Iraq or Afghanistan, or the world that we enter, you know, when we go into one of our city centres or one of our middle-class suburbs. You know, there are these worlds that we create around us, and you know, what we see actually are worlds upon worlds, you know, just overlapping, some in conflict, some in peace with each other. But you know, we can just navigate ourselves, you know, just walk through a city, it's almost like you can navigate through different worlds that environments that people have set up. It's as if we can't but create a world. We're doing it all the time as human beings. In engaging with life, we're creating a world. So obviously it's very important the sort of world we create. You know, we can create a world of friendship, harmony. We can create a world of greed, aggression. And we do it all the time, just by the way we think, act, behave, speak. We're creating a world. So, bodhisattvas, aspiring bodhisattvas, committed Buddhists, can come together to create a world that supports what is best in us as human beings, that encourages what is highest and best in ourselves and in others. Come together to create a world in which real friendship, kindness, love, understanding, and so on can grow and flourish. And actually, these days, when you really look at it, there's no getting away from other people. You can't just actually any longer go off to a cave or a hut and pursue your own path to freedom, enlightenment, if you ever could. So where's your food going to come from? And even, you know, if you've got a nice little garden sort of fenced off and you're growing your own food, if you're self-sufficient, well, you might be disturbed by robbers or terrorists. Or if you're not disturbed in that way, the streams that you draw your water from might be polluted. The air, you know, that you breathe can be polluted by all sorts of industrial poisons, radiation, accidents, whatever. You know, we are just so connected, interconnected, that in the end, our own spiritual progress has to be bound up with the happiness and welfare of all beings and all life. You know, we just can't, as it were, cut ourselves off and try and have a happy little spiritual life. You know, in the end, and probably these days very quickly, the world, other people are going to impose on us. We just have to actually take other beings into account. We have to take into account the fact that we are part of a human world. And in a very real sense, we have to bring other human beings with us. We have to take full responsibility for ourselves, for our own mental states, for our own life. That's for certain. But we also have to recognise that our own spiritual welfare and progress, and that of all beings, all life on this planet, are inextricably bound together. That's simply how it is. So from all this, it maybe begins to become a bit clearer that a Buddha field, a Buddha land, it isn't just a place. It isn't just a geographical location. That may come into it, but it's not the whole story by any means. So obviously in our own movement we have Buddhist centres, we have communities, retreat centres and so on, but it's not just about the building. You know, a Buddhist centre isn't just a building. You know, it may be a very convenient meeting place. It may be very beautiful, very valuable. But the essential ingredient is always people. You know, one can have a beautiful building, but if there's no people, there's no Buddha field, there's nothing alive. A Buddha field is alive. A Buddha field is made of living beings. So the Buddha tells us in the Vimalakirti Nidesha that the Bodhisattva creates a Buddha field out of living beings. And in the lecture, Bhante Sangharakshita said, well, yes, of course, we shouldn't understand this too literally. It's not as if the Bodhisattva is a sort of spiritual bricklayer and people, the building blocks, which he sort of slaps them together with a bit of metta or cement. You know, it's not like that, obviously. There's something much more mysterious involved. You know, it's not that the Bodhisattva can do it to people. You know, he can't sort of stick them together and create a Buddha land using people passively. The Bodhisattva can draw people together, bring them together, but one actually has to become part of a spiritual community out of one's own choice. You know, that desire to be part of a spiritual community, part of a Buddha field, it has to be woken up. We can't force people to be part of a Sangha. We can't force people to be part of a spiritual community. One can place people in really good conditions, but you can't force them to stay. And very likely they're going to want to bring bits of their own integrated selves and outside worlds into that Buddha field. And we see it here often enough. You know, mobile phones. You know. It didn't used to be a problem, but nowadays, you know, we often have to make a little announcement about mobile phones. You know, please don't use them. You know, give them to Stiramani to lock away in the safe. You know, it's like they're just so compulsive, aren't they? You know, just sort of, you know, just checking. You know, just in case. You know, there's something going on out there that I really need to know about. You know, or newspapers. You know, just checking through. You know, just making sure the world can manage without me. You know, that there's not something really important that I need to know. Or novels, you know. Come on retreat, study the Dharma, practice the Dharma, meditate, and, you know, bury yourself in a novel that takes you off, you know, to some sort of gangster-ridden world of whatever. You know, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, how devious we can be, you know, with ourselves. You know, I really want to go on retreat, I really want to get away from it all, but before long, you know, these little habits, you know, in they come, these little distractions. So yeah, it's very telling, you know, just watching ourselves, you know, how much do we really want to just practice the Dharma, and how much do we want to distract ourselves, you know, how much do we want to just be in a Buddha field and a Buddha land and really take advantage of it. You know, again, in that lecture on the Buddha field, Bhante told this story of the fish seller, old woman who went to the market to sell fish, and it took her a bit longer than usual to sell all her fish, so it was a bit too late to get back to her village. This is in India. So she managed to find in the end a flower seller who let her stay in his shop overnight. So very grateful, she lay down on the floor of the flower shop, covered herself with a bit of cloth. But she just couldn't sleep. There was just this sweet scent of all these flowers. And she tossed and turned and tried this and that. And in the end, all she could do was put the old fish basket over her head. You know, a nice fishy stink that she was used to. And off she went to sleep. So, you know, an interesting question. You know, have you brought a fish basket on retreat with you? what sort of fish basket might you be covering your head with, you know, rather than just really be on retreat? You know, what are you doing to sort of, as it were, stay in the world that you're familiar with, rather than be open to the possibility of changing, be open to the possibility of being somebody different? So, how does a bodhisattva create a Buddha field? Or more accurately, how, in cooperation with other people, does a bodhisattva build a Buddha field? Well, again, the Vimalakirti Nidesha, or the Buddha in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, has a lot to say about this. I'm not going to read all of it. He says that a bodhisattva's Buddha field is a field of positive thought. A bodhisattva's Buddha field is a field of high resolve. A bodhisattva's Buddha field is a field of virtuous application. A field of generosity, of morality. A field of tolerance, a field of effort, a field of meditation. A field of wisdom. A Buddha field consists of the four immeasurables. It consists of the four means of unification. It consists in skill in liberative technique. It consists of the 37 aids to enlightenment. A bodhisattva's Buddha field is his mind of total dedication. And so it goes on. Put simply, a Buddha field is a field of spiritual practice. So we have this extensive list of all the different spiritual practices that, you know, traditional practices that we build a field, a Buddha field out of. And today I want to focus on just one short list known as the four Sangrahavastus, or elements of conversion, or means of unification. So it's sometimes said in the Mahayana, in the great way, the Bodhisattva strives for enlightenment for all. First of all, he perfects himself, gives rise to profound wisdom and compassion with himself through the practice of the six perfections, the six paramitas. And we're going to be hearing about that practice of the six paramitas over the remaining talks. And then he practices the four Sangrahavastus. Out of this depth of practice, he's then able to practice the four Sangrahavastus and bring others together to create a Buddha field. So this teaching of the four Sangrahavastus, or Sangrahavatus in Pali, is found through the whole Buddhist tradition. There's notable examples of it in the earliest tradition of the Pali Canon, the stories of the historical Buddha. In particular, there's the story of Hataka, a famous lay disciple of the Buddha, who comes one day to the Buddha with 500 disciples of his own. 500, but in the Pali text, by the way, usually means just a lot. It doesn't mean literally 500, it's just the way they said a lot in those days. So Hataka appears with his great retinue of disciples. So this is quite telling as well. I mean, I don't know how many of you are aware, but the Buddha had a number of very important lay disciples who also had quite a following of their own. So Hataka appeared with his disciples, and well, the Buddha was very pleased to see Hataka and his followers, who were, you know, through Hataka also followers of the Buddha. And he asked Hataka, "Well, how did you bring together such a community of disciples?" And Hataka says, "Well, by means of the four Sangrahavatus that you taught me," and which he then goes on to expound. And yeah, we find this teaching of the four Sangrahavastus then there in the Pali Canon and throughout the Mahayana tradition, appearing in such works as the Vimlakirti Nidesha. There's a slight shift in one of them, which I'll come to later, but that's not that important. So what are these four Sangraha Vastus by means of which the Bodhisattva creates a Buddha field, a spiritual community, builds a Buddha land? Well, they are dana, generosity. They are priyavardita, kindly, affectionate speech. They are artacharya, doing good, beneficial activity, and seminata, exemplification. And I'm going to just say now a little bit in turn about each of these Sangraha Vastus. So the first one is dana, generosity. And we're going to hear a lot more about dana tomorrow, because it's also the first of the perfections. It's the first of the perfections practiced by the Bodhisattva, and Lokeshwara will be talking about that tomorrow. And we also know it as the positive counterpart of the second precept. It's sometimes said to be the foundation of the whole spiritual life. You know, in the East you sometimes have a series of dana, sila, samadhi, prajna. So dana, generosity, is the very beginning of the spiritual life, the beginning of going out from oneself to others, and on that you build the other foundations in sila, samadhi, prajna. But I'm going to just talk today about dana as a means of unification, as a way of creating sangha. We're going to hear much more about it, much more broadly, tomorrow. So we're here, dana is practiced as a way of dismantling the barriers between people, of dismantling the barriers of self-interest, creating a sense of real communality of interest, creating a flow of warmth, kindness, mutual care and concern. And in a way, it's very easy to practice dana, generosity. You just, over these next 2 weeks, you know, there's going to be countless opportunities just for small acts of friendliness. You know, opening a door for someone, passing the bread, you know, just all sorts of small ways of just being aware of others, responding to their needs, just having that sense of a readiness to respond, care for, help others, just look after the environment, look after each other. And it's one of those things, you know, the more we practice generosity, the easier it gets, the more it just becomes a natural part of how we are. And it is just a very obvious way in which we can set about building a Buddha land and, you know, just living together on a retreat, together for the next 2 weeks, and just bringing in this attitude of open-handed, open-hearted generosity to the way in which we do our duties, take care of the place and of each other. And I think we can say that essentially dana is an attitude. It's not simply the giving. It's this attitude of open-handed, open-hearted response to others, to life, to the world, where one's letting go of grasping, letting go of clinging. One's always ready to direct energy resources to where they're most needed and most helpful. And I think this whole attitude is summed up in the dedication of merits, the verses of dedication of merits that we do at the end of the puja, where we give away all the spiritual benefits of our practice to the welfare of others. And again, this is a very important Buddhist practice, dedication of merits. It's as if the momentum we create through our spiritual practice, we're constantly giving it away, sharing it with others. There's no sense of appropriating it, trying to become someone, something special, spiritual. There's a lovely image for this that an order member called Ratnaketu once came up with in a talk that I've used quite often, for this whole idea of giving away one's merits. So he spoke of us having this sort of rusty, heavy iron ball that we just hold in front of our heart, and it's me, it's mine, you know, you can't have it, so there. But then one day, somehow, something happens, you know, maybe the sun's shining, you know, it's spring or something, and we just find ourselves throwing the ball, this ball of mine, to someone else. And amazingly, surprisingly, it just comes back almost immediately, but it's sort of a bit lighter and not quite so dull and rusty. And we start thinking, oh, this is good. We throw it off again, and it comes back again. And before long, there's this wonderful sort of shining ball of light and jewels, you know, that's we're just sort of throwing, and it's coming back to us, and it's just becoming more and more radiant and beautiful. But what we have to watch out for then, you know, is that we don't sort of at some point, oh, look at this. Look what I've done. Look what I've got. Well, I don't know that, you know, your hands are a bit dirty. You know, you're not having my ball. So we start holding on to it. And, you know, the more we hold on to it, the more the jewels drop off. The rust comes back. And we can end up just holding again this rusty iron ball. You know, I think that sort of, that little sort of image sums up very well this whole attitude of dedication of merits, giving away our merits. You know, this sense that we just have to keep everything flowing, keep our spiritual life flowing. As soon as the ego comes back in, look at me, aren't I holy, aren't I good? It all starts to go rigid and wrong again. I think there's a very strong connection as well between dana and faith, shraddha. Somehow, you know, whatever level we're practicing dana at, we need shraddha to be there. You know, it's like you give something away, somehow you trust, well, that's fine, no worry. The tendency is always to hoard a bit, isn't it? Well, you know, if I sort of pass this box of chocolates around, you know, there's one, two, oh dear, you know, it's not going to get back to me, is it? I'm not going to have one, you know, sort of. You know, we sort of look after ourselves. We calculate in our generosity. And I think when this attitude of faith and trust comes in, well, we just give and we trust we're going to get what we need. You know, we don't need to hold back. We don't need to always sort of keep a little bit back for ourselves. You know, we can just cultivate more and more that attitude of being, yeah, just trusting in life, trusting in the spiritual life, just giving readily, you know, whatever we see needs to be given, and trusting we'll get what we need. So I think faith, trust, if you like, in the spiritual path, trust in the spiritual process, and a deepening generosity do go very much hand in hand. So then the second sangrahavastu, priyavadita, kindly, affectionate speech. So there's an awful lot of stuff comes out of our mouths all the time, every day. You know, we've all pretty much got quite a lot to say. You know, it just sort of comes out, doesn't it? Lots and lots of words. It's just recognising, you know, it matters. You know, what we say actually shapes who we are, shapes what we become, and it shapes the world around us. So it's actually really important that that our speech is an expression of friendliness, interest, concern, encouragement, and that we're avoiding those tendencies that is so easy to fall into of harsh speech, unkind speech, cynicism, gossip. So, yeah, the importance of kindly, affectionate speech, priyavadita. And again, it's not just a matter of being nice, you know, always sort of saying nice things to people. Now, I think priyavartita, kindly, affectionate speech, it actually can also be quite challenging, quite uncompromising, if behind it, motivating it, is a real concern for people's best interests. You know, it's not just that we don't like them or don't like what they're doing. We're actually really seeing them. Our speech is a reflection of a real concern for the best for others. And above all, we could say Priyavardhita kindly speech is going to be a speech that encourages the best in people. You know, all too often people lack confidence in life, lack confidence in their own spiritual abilities and qualities. So we can actually remind people of their own qualities, of their own potential, bring a warmth and lightness to situations. So Priyavartita is about what we say, but it's also a reminder, you know, about what we all too easily leave unsaid. You know, if we can think of all the things that we might have said but didn't say, you know, those expressions of gratitude and appreciation. You know, it's certainly something that Bhante has very much encouraged us, you know, just to really express gratitude and appreciation to parents, you know, to those who've helped us over time. You know, that we don't just take it for, well, of course they know I'm grateful. Of course they know. We don't need to say it. Actually, it can mean a lot just expressing our gratitude to friends, family, and so on. You know, that actually the saying of it makes a difference. You know, actually expressing our gratitude, expressing our appreciation. We can also think in terms of a readiness to forgive, let go, but not simply doing it in our own minds, but also, you know, without being pompous, righteous, and so on. Actually just letting people know it's gone. You know, I've let it go. It's forgiven. It's behind us. We can just go on. You know, we don't have to hold on to things. And we can let others know we're not holding on. So expressing, you know, in the most positive way, and not in a self-righteous way, again, forgiveness as well as a gratitude and appreciation. So again, we can see kindly speech is above all the expression of an inner attitude of love, concern, kindness, interest. And that when we express that, when we put it out into the world, it actually allows people to relax, to open, to flower, to actually begin to become who they truly might be. So, Priyavardhita, kindly speech, affectionate speech. Then the third of the Sangrahavastus, the third of the means of unification by which the Bodhisattva creates a Buddha field is Artacharya, doing good, beneficial activity, or another translation, seeking the welfare of others. So it can mean just helping people in all sorts of worldly ways, you know, small acts of kindness, friendliness, you know, obviously countless ways in which one can do good in a very ordinary way. But specifically, Artacharya is about helping people to develop spiritually, about bringing out and encouraging in the best in them, enabling them in their own turn to be able to do good in the world. So sometimes Artacharya is taken quite specifically as meaning teaching, communicating the Dharma. But, well, it certainly can be that, but it's obviously more than just, you know, giving people lists to relate to or sort of explaining Buddhism to them. It's actually about creating the conditions that enable people to come together to practice the Dharma, discover and develop what's deepest and best in themselves through engagement with that deeper, if you like, spirit and meaning of the Dharma. So actually communicating that living spirit of the Dharma, inspiring and encouraging people to practice for themselves, sparking them off. So we could speak of the Bodhisattva, if you like, as being metaphorically like that candle that lights many other candles so they can begin to burn, if you like, under their own fuel. So Artacharya then is very much this doing good is very much that sort of activity that enables others to also awaken the Dharma in themselves. And then the final sangrahavastu, samanata, which in the Mahayana is translated, understood as exemplification. So the Bodhisattva creates a Buddha field, helps create a Sangha through exemplification. So this doesn't mean trying to exemplify being a Buddha in an artificial way. You know, it doesn't mean having an idea in one's head of what a Buddha looks like and then going around trying to be a Buddha, you know, perhaps be ever so mindful and saying nice things to people and so on. What exemplification actually means here is simply exemplifying somebody who is honestly, sincerely dedicating themselves to going for refuge to the Three Jewels, trying to transform themselves in the light of the Buddha and his teachings, as a part of a spiritual community of like-minded individuals. So, yeah, we've got the old adages, haven't we, of walk the talk and practice what you preach. So what the Bodhisattva exemplifies, you could say, is an intense, effective spiritual life with all the successes and failures and ups and downs that trying to really practice the Dharma is going to involve. You know, it's not always going to be easy. In fact, it's probably often going to be really demanding. And just exemplifying somebody responding to the demands of facing difficulties, facing challenges, acknowledging their own limitations, trying to move beyond them and so on, working with habits that one's a bit stuck with, all of this, you know, just really working again and again on the business of transformation. So it's the embodiment, you could say, not of a fixed point, but of the exemplification, not of a fixed point, of embodying a fixed point, but the exemplification of what being engaged in a process of spiritual transformation can involve. So I mentioned also there was a shift in meaning in this fourth Sangrahavastu from its earlier significance in the Pali canon. And in the earlier list, samanata was understood as empathy. It actually came up in a discussion in our discussion group this morning. There's a distinction in counselling often made between apathy, which is just indifference to other people, sympathy, which is sort of feeling for other people, but on a basis of self-reference, if you like. You know, I feel very sorry for them, and it's sort of, somehow it's to do with me and my feelings. And then empathy, which is to do with just somehow putting self-ego aside and just developing a real fellow feeling, a real sense of the other and what it is like to be in their shoes. But with that, a sense of perspective, a sense of, not just sort of being lost in their difficulties, but somehow really in their shoes, but at the same time maintaining a sort of a breadth and depth of perspective that isn't lost, isn't entangled. Again, Shantideva in the Bodhicharya Avatara speaks of the practice of exchange of self and other. So we have at the same time this this real empathy, this real fellow feeling with the other, and at the same time this sense of perspective, awareness of their deepest potential. I don't know if many of you have come across the Vajrasattva practice ever, but there's one of the visualization and mantra recitation practices that is done where one visualizes oneself with Vajrasattva above one's head. and is purified by him. But then one also has this sense of all beings sort of around one, and all of them with a Vajrasattva above their head, also being purified by Vajrasattva. So it's this profound sense that, yes, one has one's own, if you like, spiritual potential. But then also, in every other living being, there is that same spiritual potential, that same striving to be something more that can become conscious and become realized, if you like, through the practice of the Buddhist path. And that's somehow embodied in that image of Vajrasattva above one's own head, and then that empathetic, compassionate recognition of all other beings also with that Vajrasattva above their head. So we have these four Sangrahavastus through which the Bodhisattva builds a Buddha field together with other living beings, through which the Bodhisattva brings together a spiritual community. Through dana, generosity, priyavadita, loving speech, and artacharya, doing good, samanata, exemplification, or empathy. So through the practice of these four Sangrahavastus, at whatever level we're able to really engage them, we can work together to create a Buddha field, begin, if you like, to purify a Buddha field. And you know, we can really very much bear then these four Sangrahavastus in mind together over the next week or 2 weeks as we live and practice here together on this retreat, creating a Buddha field, Buddha land together.